took my hand, said, I see a bright future. I'm just not sure that you're in it. That's Julia Jacklin. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. A lot of talk about the future yesterday as Mark Shapiro spoke with Toronto media in the afternoon. Nothing really headline worthy, nothing new, nothing you wouldn't expect. You know, not saying for certain that Ross Atkins' job is safe, not saying for certain Ross Atkins is out. Other than, hey, we don't expect payroll to be less next year. And yeah, we dipped below the CBT line for right now. There wasn't a ton to take away from it. We'll talk to Caitlin McGrath about it in a little bit here. We've got a pretty loaded show. Alan Doyle, formerly of Great Big Sea and now, of course, of his solo work, will join us around 10:30. Will Wagner of the Buffalo Bisons, who the Blue Jays acquired at the trade deadline, going to join us around 11:15. We'll also talk to Doug Fox, our favorite Blue Jays prospect guy, who was down in Buffalo for a doubleheader yesterday. Talk to Michael Bauman a little later as well. But yeah, Shapiro was the headline item. The Jays then went out and lost 7-3, a game where Bowden Francis looked pretty good and the bullpen was very bad. Mark Shapiro, asked about what went wrong in 2024 before the game, pointed to the bullpen first. I personally would probably have pointed to the offense first and the amount of underperformance there. But yeah, the bullpen being the second worst in all of baseball, always teetering on the worst. And then like Victor Vodnik will get lit up for Colorado and push them back into 30th. So yeah, a lot of issues, a lot of things to address for this front office. You know, you're going to hear things like learning and be better and stuff like that. They can't do anything right now on August 8th. We'll see when October, November roll around what they have planned, because as much as they may value continuity and stability, and there is an argument in good organizations that continuity and stability is, quote, a competitive advantage, I would say, A, that is only really true if you're doing good things and have had results. And B, there's also a risk of, you know, things like groupthink and, you know, getting tunnel vision and things like that, where sometimes a fresh perspective or fresh eyes, at least added to the group, can be helpful. Let's see what Caitlin McGrath thought about the presser yesterday. She is of The Athletic. She joins us now. Caitlin, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. So high level, what'd you think? Not a ton really like headline worthy, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you summed it up well. There wasn't a ton to take away from Mark's comments, but at the same time, like doing it sort of beginning of August-ish, there probably wasn't going to be any sort of definitive takeaways, just because, you know, you can always fall back on the season's not over yet. We want to wait till the end of the season to sort of make our conclusions. You know, I think the thing that everybody was wondering about, like you knew the question was coming, was on Ross Atkins' future. I mean, that's sort of the big overarching question hanging over the Blue Jays for the remainder of the season is what's the future of the front office, specifically Ross. And I thought his answer was kind of predictable in the sense that I didn't think that he was going to come out strongly necessarily either way. I thought he was going to find a way to kind of walk the middle, which is exactly what he did. He sort of fell back on the fact that he doesn't like to comment on job status during the season and sort of definitively said he's not going to do that, but then also gave an answer about how he values continuity and stability. And, you know, from that, you think, he obviously doesn't sort of generally believe that firing a GM or making a sort of change is always the solution. So he kind of answered it in a way where you could say, you know, you could see a future where Ross Atkins continues to be the GM, but he didn't necessarily give a huge vote of confidence for Ross. I don't even really think he said Ross's name in his answer. He just kind of said, generally speaking, that's the view that he takes on building sports organizations, is that he values stability and continuity. So I think it could go either way. I'm not sure that, you know, the decision is necessarily his alone as well, in terms of the fact that I think that, you know, ownership will have a say in it as well and what they believe will be the best. But other than that, it was a lot of the things that we thought he would say. You know, we got to be better. We're disappointed. You know, there's a lot of work ahead of us. You know, payroll is expected to be the same or, you know, not change a lot moving forward. So it wasn't groundbreaking in his comments, but I think that there was still a lot to take away from it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's a good point you make that, you know, who knows to what degree the decision is his, because, no, look, nobody wants a corporate ownership meddling in the day-to-day baseball operations. But if you spend $250 million over a couple seasons and you don't have the results to show for it, you know, higher levels are going to ask some questions, maybe. And then there was also, you know, with respect to that $250 million, and I'm using a rough approximation here, you know, again, that comment that they don't expect payroll to be, even though they acknowledge that, yes, if we lose more games, fans don't spend as much money. And I know I saw some reaction on Twitter of like, fans don't like that it's framed that way and it's a revenue focus and things like that. I understand that. But if you are a fan and all you want is a winning team, the fact that they are acknowledging that winning is better for revenue, like we all live in a capitalist society. Let's acknowledge that part. And then, hey, at least winning aligns with revenue in this case. When it comes to those bigger evaluations. And, you know, you're right. If you're Ross Atkins, you didn't get fired, but you didn't get a contract extension and you got the evaluations are still ongoing thing, you're probably at least a little nervous. The idea that the continuity and, you know, familiarity and things like that are valuable, to what extent do you feel that's only, like, or to what extent do you feel it's true, but also to what extent do you feel it's only really true if you're having results? Because I know they made the playoffs a couple times and wild card series are random and things like that, but top 10 spending, bottom 10 farm system, bottom 10 major league results over the tenure of this group, it's, I don't know, it's a little hard to marry that there is value in continuity when those have been the results for 9 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you're looking at a sports team, there is some value in stability. If you're like looking at a major league team and, you know, things hit a bad skid, it's not necessarily productive to constantly be changing manager, for example, right? Like there is some situations where it's like you got to ride out your leadership a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I do think the broader point of this isn't like, you know, a 2-3-4 year period that we're talking about with this front office and with this, you know, with Ross Atkins specifically. I mean, he came in at what, the end of 2015, 2016 was his first season, you know, fully as the GM. And obviously the Blue Jays make the playoffs that year, but it's a little bit of a holdover group from Alex Anthopoulos. So when you're talking about, you know, their run, it's more so starting with the rebuild in 2018, more or less, this kind of group that comes up in 2019 and starts to be competitive in 2020. And then, yeah, there are some good years. And, you know, having a team that hovers around 90 wins is a successful team. And I think that, you know, they have done a good job in certain aspects of it. I think that, you know, Ross Atkins' trade history is honestly pretty favorable. I think that he's probably made more good trades than bad trades, generally speaking. But at the same time, like at what point do you just have to evaluate, you know, the on-field product and the success of the on-field product? And the success is, it comes down to winning in the postseason and getting to the World Series. And yes, you can look at this team and say, okay, yeah, they've been competitive, you know, more often than they haven't been in the last, you know, 5-6 years. But they also haven't won a playoff series. They haven't won a playoff game. And I think that that's what it comes down to. I think that, you know, it's interesting. Like, I don't know, like I see how Shapiro doesn't necessarily want to react to, you know, fan frustration and maybe there's this one season and say, oh, no, we got to change everything up. But at the same time, when you look at the broader picture, like where is the success beyond getting into the postseason a few times? I don't know that that's enough for a team that, you know, when we're talking about them in 2019 and 2020, we're like, wow, this is going to be a dynasty here. Like this is a team that, you know, could be favored for years to come and could be one of the best teams in the majors. And it just has not been that.
Yeah. And look, it's one thing to have, you know, hey, oh, we got in the wild card and it didn't go our way a couple of times. Like we can all recognize that a best 2 out of 3 series has some randomness to it, but also you can win the division and avoid the wild card entirely. You can get back there more times. You can have the waves of pitching prospects that you were supposed to have so that, you know, you don't either don't have to have a top 7 payroll to compete or can do that and you know, not have to spend it all on your starting rotation. So, yeah, that's a lot of stuff that we'll talk about again in October, I'm sure. Let's move the page a little bit to 2025, Caitlin, and let's put who is making those decisions aside just a bit here. Mark Shapiro was also asked a lot about, you know, okay, so you're intending to compete again in 2025. What gives you the confidence that you can do that? And he said that they think they have a core that they can build a championship contender with. Now, of course, because it's Twitter and stuff, some people took that as like this group alone can compete for a championship. No, I think they're saying they could add to this group with the flexibility they have. However, a lot of work to do in that regard. Did you get a sense from Shapiro's presser of where that work may focus, or even if they've gotten to that part of their kind of off-season planning yet?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like they've gotten too deep in off-season planning. Again, maybe because some decisions hinge on, you know, who is actually leading the group. You know, I don't know if we know that definitively yet. Obviously, we just talked about. But I think that, you know, just looking at the roster and maybe using what some things that Mark said, I mean, he really kind of identified the bullpen as an area that has really sunk them this year, which I actually agree with what you said. I thought that was not the most obvious thing. I thought the bullpen breaking down obviously was a huge issue this year, but I mean, for the first month or 6 weeks, it was the offense that wasn't scoring. I mean, the bullpen, you know, if you score one or two runs a game, it doesn't matter what your bullpen does. But anyway, you know, but I think that obviously the bullpen needs to be rebuilt. Like, that's obvious. The Blue Jays don't really have a bullpen at the moment. I mean, they do have one, but in terms of guys that you can rely on, guys that, you know, can take the ball in and hold leads and stuff, they're not really at that level right now. So the bullpen will need a lot of work. I think the starting rotation probably needs at least one or two starters. Manoah's obviously going to be out to start the year. You've got Berríos, Bassett, and Gausman as your starting point. I think Yariel Rodriguez has shown some good signs this year. Is it enough to necessarily pencil him in as one of the starters? I don't know. Bowden Francis obviously is getting a bit of runway here, and he looked good last night. But again, like, has he done enough to sort of cement his job? Probably not. There probably needs more time. Some recent acquisitions, you know, Bloss, who we haven't seen yet, but obviously he's a guy that has experienced a little bit of the major leagues. So to me, those are three guys that more so represent depth. And I think the Blue Jays have really lacked that in years. So if they have three guys that could be depth for them, that's really good. So, but I still think you need to go out and get, you know, probably two starters, maybe, you know, at the least one, but definitely some experienced starters. And then, as you say, like the offense to me needs pretty significant overhaul. I don't think it needs, you know, to be completely torn up and thrown away. Obviously, you've got some pieces. Vlad, obviously, going to lead the way for the team. Hopefully George comes in, George Springer comes in and doesn't struggle as much as he did to start the year. But yeah, like, you need to figure out the offense. You obviously need a couple more big bats to be able to, you know, help guys like Vladdy compliment him, right? It feels like they don't really have that. And yes, some of the young guys are showing some potential. Leo Jimenez looked good last night. Spencer Horwitz obviously has had a strong start to his season this year. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work ahead. And Mark Shapiro kind of left it open-ended where it's like he kind of said, we believe that we have a core that we can build around, and we believe that there's enough pieces out there to sort of make this a competitive team. But he also said there's a lot of work ahead, and we're not sort of at the point where we can make definitive statements about 25 yet. And you know, just kind of emphasize that their intent to compete is clear, and that's what they want to do, but not necessarily saying definitively, like, you know, in 25 we're going to have a championship team. So maybe that leaves the window open for if things don't go wrong in the offseason, or things don't go right in the offseason, sorry, maybe they switch things up, maybe they change the lever, maybe they make some kind of dramatic trades.
Yeah, I mean, that is the option, right? You just kind of hover the finger over the eject button. And you know, Shapiro also got asked about extensions for Vlad and Bo. And of course, he's not going to comment on those other than to say, yeah, it's easier to build a championship level team if you have those guys locked up. But until they're locked up long term, you're always going to be looking at, well, if things go poorly, you know, do you sell them? Is Vlad the most interesting, you know, deadline rental since Juan Soto in 2025 and that kind of thing? The other element of that, I guess, is, and he wasn't asked about this specifically, but I wonder your take on it. If you're trying to sign free agents, this offseason. And it's one thing if it's like Justin Turner and Kevin Kiermaier and Brandon Belt, who are coming in on one-year deals and that kind of thing, or Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, who's a multi-year deal, but you're paying more than people expected him to get, things like that. Those guys are a different tier. But if you're trying to go out and you're trying to get a meaningful piece, an Alex Bregman type or something like that, the risk of trying to do that without Vlad locked up and to a lesser extent Bo locked up, do you think that's more difficult because a guy's going to be looking at a multi-year, you know, window for this team and it's unclear where the path to competitiveness is past 2025?
No, I think that's a really good point, because when you look back at when they were signing guys like George Springer or Kevin Gausman and even Chris Bassett to an extent, Yusei Kikuchi, there was still a lot of runway for the team in terms of years of control for Bo and Vlad and some of their other pieces. So it's a lot easier to sign free agents then, and obviously you give them the money that they want, when you can say, well, we've got 4 years of competitive window here with Vlad and Bo and they're the guys that we're building around. And, you know, at the start of that, like you could say, like, you know, I think 2020, it's like, okay, we make some progress, and then you bring in a bunch of guys and you can kind of point to an upward trajectory for the team, or like, we think we'll go this way. But now you're trying to sign free agents and you're saying, well, we are a team that has had this, you know, talented core, and we haven't won a postseason game. We missed the postseason in 2024. It's a harder sell. And yes, you can emphasize the city, you can emphasize guys love our organization, we've made renovations, we have a nice spring training facility in Florida. Like, you can still use all those things to sell your organization. And you know, the Blue Jays do have a pretty good reputation in terms of guys who come in and do enjoy being part of the organization. But also, these are professional athletes that want to win. So I think that, to your point, like, it is a lot harder to sign a free agent to, you know, a multi-year deal when there's so many question marks around the team. You know, Gausman's only signed a couple more years. Chris Bassett will be a free agent after next season. I think Berríos has that opt-out too. So there's like a lot of things that, you know, this team could be completely different in after next season, unless you have some certainty with Vlad. I do think that, like, you know, to emphasize that point, like, I think the Vlad extension, to lesser extent Bo, I think there's just sort of a bit more certainty that maybe Vlad is the guy that you could convince to stay here for the right amount, obviously. And I just think that has to be the number one priority this offseason. Like, I don't think you can go forward with this team with having both those guys potentially walking after next year. And I think that Vlad has shown you this year that he can be the guy, he can be the MVP type guy. And I think that, you know, you're always going to look at those deals and they're going to hurt. They're going to feel like a lot of money. You're going to worry about how they look in those last years. Doesn't matter at this point. Like, you got to lock him up. You got to find a way forward with Vlad, because he's the guy that you need to build around. He's the guy that can be the face of your franchise, and he's perfect for it. He would embrace it. And I think that he's honestly shown enough. And I think that there would be too many question marks for your team going forward if you don't find a way to go forward with Vlad.
And yeah, I think maybe you don't, especially after yesterday, I already felt this way, but yeah, maybe just as a first baseman though, after the tough day yesterday. Last one for you on the Shapiro presser. Not particularly surprising, but did you take anything from him pushing the John Schneider question off to, I mean, I don't know if he specifically said Atkins or like that's an offseason decision, but he basically no commented on the future of John Schneider.
Yeah, I mean, I think he generally does that. I mean, he a lot of times when you ask specifically about like coaching staff or very specific roster decisions, he usually likes to punt that to Ross. It's not uncommon for him to say that. So I personally didn't take much of it. Maybe that's just because I've heard him do it a lot of times. Maybe I should have read into it more. You know, he didn't answer necessarily about the future, wanted Ross to answer that, but he did say that he's happy with the job the coaching staff has done. You know, they've come in and they've still remained kind of focused on winning and being the best possible team. There hasn't been, you know, I think he said like finger pointing and blaming of each other. So he said that, the coaching staff, the leadership of the coaching staff, he hasn't looked at as, you know, an issue or a problem this year. If anything, they've sort of tried their best in a season that hasn't gone right. So I didn't read too much into it. I do think it's, I think it all trickles from the decision when it comes to the front office, though. I mean, like, obviously, if you do decide to bring in a new GM, then either they're going to have the opportunity, if they want, to bring in their own manager. Like, that is generally sometimes what happens. So I think we just kind of have to wait and see, because I think that the decisions at the top will ultimately start to trickle down a little bit.
Yeah, and I mostly just asked that one because as we came on here, we got the news that the Chicago White Sox have dismissed Pedro Grifol, who is coming off an American League record tying losing streak and has a team 61 games below 500. Not exactly where the Blue Jays are. Maybe closer to expectations though than the Blue Jays were here. Caitlin, turning it quickly to last night's game, Jays lose. Vlad remains hot. Bowden Francis, probably the headline item, shakes off a rough first inning to go five innings again. He had gone 5 2/3 against Baltimore last time out. Not blowing anyone away necessarily, but his ability to once again shake off that poor start and give them some length. What have you made of Bowden's last couple outings?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Bowden is interesting because he's kind of getting a reset now. I mean, he came in to start the year with an opportunity to be a starter with the injury to Manoa, was in their rotation, obviously didn't get off to the start that he wanted, has kind of bounced around not only with between the Blue Jays and the minor leagues, but also between being a starter and being a reliever. I think he says he's more comfortable as a starter. I think he likes that role for himself. And he's a guy that, you know, this stuff is really good. I think Eno Saris at The Athletic has written about him, has highlighted some of his pitches, you know, the curveball, the slider. He's got the splitter that he's been using this year, and it's been a better pitch for him. So when you look at sort of the data behind the stuff, like, it all looks really good. And John Schneider has kind of mentioned that too. It's like, it's not about stuff with him. Like, he's got it. It's just kind of about execution. It's about never taking a pitch off. And I think that's stuff that you can learn through experience. And I think that obviously the majors are, you know, a different beast than the minor leagues. And so it's Bowden kind of going through the process of learning at the major league level and learning that, again, yeah, you can never take a pitch off. You can never just like flip in, you know, a fastball or flip in a lazy curveball and hope that it gets by guys. You have to really execute every single pitch, move your pitches around, you know, make sure you're keeping guys guessing. And so I think that over the last couple starts, Bowden's kind of done a better job of that. It looks like he's executing his pitches a lot better. I think the Blue Jays are pleased with where he's locating the pitches and everything. So it's nice to see him, you know, get that reset a little bit. Maybe there's a little less pressure on him now. Obviously, the team, you know, is just in a mode where they're basically evaluating what they have as opposed to competing for the postseason as they were in the start of the year. So you hope that he can kind of take this opportunity and gain a lot from it. And he's a guy that is always very reflective of his performances, always, you know, even in his struggles, has appreciated the learning opportunities that those provide. You know, he's a very unique individual, very zen. And so I think he's been pleased with what he's done. And I think the Blue Jays have been pleased with what he's done lately too.
Very zen is a good way to put it. You know, skeleton lotus flower meditation tattoo and feet in the grass, even though it's turf and all that stuff. Really hoping he can build on this and continue to give them some good innings there in the fifth starter spot. Caitlin, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. I'll see you down at the park tomorrow.
Awesome. Thank you.
Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. A lot of great stuff up there as usual, but particularly some takeaways from that Mark Shapiro press conference. And yeah, while you're over at The Athletic, this was a post-deadline thing, so you have to scroll back a little bit. But Eno did write about 10 players he thinks will get a little more opportunity post-deadline that he likes and wants to see more of. And Bowden Francis was one of those. Maybe we'll talk to Eno next week if you know, time zone cooperates and things like that. Let's take a break right now. When we come back, we're gonna lighten it up a little bit. Obviously, the Mark Shapiro end of season doom and gloom stuff is heavy. So let's talk to one of the best at lightening it up. Let's talk to Alan Doyle, a Newfoundland musician who's playing at Budweiser stage on Saturday. One of my personal favorites and my first ever concert when I was a kid. My dad is from Belle Island, Newfoundland, and lives there. So big, great Big C family, big Alan Doyle family. We'll talk to him on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to JS Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That is the sound of Alan Doyle, who will be performing at Bud Stage on Saturday. I'm really looking forward to it, going down with my youngest brother. Alan Doyle himself joins us now. Alan, thanks so much for doing this. How we doing?
Oh, fantastic day. I'm here in St. John's, fly up to Toronto later tomorrow, and off we go on Saturday for the greatest kitchen party ever.
I'm looking forward to it. Joel Plaskett, Emergency, Tom Power hosting. We got a lineup there. Should be a lot of fun. What does a Toronto trip look like for you? Like, what are you trying to check off while you're in town for the weekend?
Oh, I always have a great time in Toronto. I always did. So, you know, the biggest thing for me in Toronto is I always love walking on the waterfront. I'm a homeboy for the East Coast, I suppose, so I'll spend a bit of time down there and then get out to Bud Stage and have a great day on Saturday. Looking forward to it.
So I know, Alan, this is a Blue Jay show, so we'll talk a little bit of Blue Jays here. I know you've done a couple Jays games in the past. Are you going to be able to fit one in this weekend or too tight?
Well, I think there's one tomorrow night, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward. I think I might be able to get in for a few innings tomorrow night, and I do dearly love it. It's great fun. And even back in the days when Great Big Sea, where we're touring all the time, we used to stay in the hotel there and watch the games out the window. We had great fun. I must say I love it. And, I look forward to having a great Toronto weekend this weekend, too.
You also, if I'm remembering, I think 2019, you sang the national anthems as part of your Dollar a Day mental health project. Is that right?
That's correct. And singing any singer in the world knows, singing the national anthem is one of the most terrifying gigs there is in the world, because everybody loves to repost videos of people shagging up the national anthem. It's like the national pastime or something. And so it's terrifying, but my God, it's great fun to be on the floor of the field and to have a little part in that afternoon or evening or whatever. It's really great. And we just did a tour in the U.S. and we went to three or four of the big sort of famous ball fields down there just in the afternoons. We were in Kansas City and St. Louis, and we all did a couple of ball games. And it's what a great day. It's fantastic. So I hope to go tomorrow night.
I was going to ask about that because you've been doing a bit of a hot dog journey there. Have you got an opinion on where's got the best hot dog so far?
Well, I can tell you this, and this is outside of baseball. I've been saying this. Anybody who knows me knows I've been saying this my entire adult life. Nowhere in the world beats Toronto for street meat. Best street hot dogs in the world. People from New York and Boston are horrified to hear you say it, but it is the truth. It's fantastic, and I'm looking forward to it.
Alan, so my dad lives on Belle Island, and if he was in town... Yeah, he does, yeah. Just across from you guys. So if he was to come down and visit, he'd tell me, he'd be like, meet me at the hot dog vendor. And there's 400 hot dog vendors out there, but I know exactly what one he means because he's got the one special hot dog vendor that he thinks is the good one down here as well. So he's with you on that one.
Oh, there's the same family that have been operating one. Like, I believe it's right at if you're facing the ball field from, Front Street or whatever, it's the one closest to the right, like at the bottom of, I think it's John Street, right on the corner of John and Front or whatever. And it's like, that's the aces, but they're all pretty good. They're all pretty good.
So you've been a sports fan for a long time, Alan, and I know, you kept an eye on your Habs through the playoffs here. But back in, I can't remember if it was 92 or 93. I've heard you tell this story before, but you guys are at a bar playing while the Blue Jays are in the World Series. Can you refresh me on that story? Tell me what you remember about it.
Yeah, I was before Great Big Sea started even. I was still playing at Trapper John's in St. John's, and I just finished the song, and I got a very unusual big round of applause, and I thought I really killed that Stan Rogers cover or whatever had just played. What I realized is that Joe had just hit the home run.
Ah, man, that's a good one. I'm sure some of the cheers are for you too. Look, the nice thing too, and a cool thing about music and the sports overlap is there are a bunch of people out there who associate you and your music with that Joe Carter home run now.
Definitely, and it's like one of the great blessings of my life is to have been part of the soundtrack for great events in people's lives, even like having a few songs in the hockey games or, just recently we had one of our songs in the World Cup or rather the World Juniors, and stuff. And it's just fun. It's fun to be a part of it.
Yeah. It's a blast. I had to ask as well, cause I know you're a Montreal Canadiens fan. I know I've seen you post on Instagram in a Montreal Expos hat. Were you an Expos fan until they moved off, or were you always a Jays guy?
I think I was always a Jays guy. I'm not totally sure why. I guess, I mean, the Expos, remind me when the Expos left.
94, like, I want to, or 95, yeah. I want to say.
Yeah. I feel like I would have cheered for either Canadian team. But I feel like when I really started watching baseball, the Jays were the thing to watch. And I guess, you know, so, and which is odd because, but I, you know, I'm one of those odd Montreal Canadiens fans that kind of, my second favorite team in the league is the Toronto Maple Leafs. And like the, and which is very weird. You're supposed to be dead enemies, you know, but of course for most of my young life here growing up in St. John's, we had the St. John's Maple Leafs, right? We had the baby Leafs. And so I had an affinity for both Montreal and Toronto, but the Habs are my main team, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and sorry, it's 04 the Expos left. 94 is when they got robbed of the World Series with the strike shortened. Yeah. I'm mixing up my dates here. Yeah. I did want to ask about that. So, you know, I know you guys had the baby Leafs there. I've got a St. John's Ice Caps jersey somewhere in storage. But yeah. So, my, like I said, my dad and my family are from Newfoundland, and they're all Leaf fans. Yeah. And I just kind of assumed because of that everyone in Newfoundland picked up the Leafs. How did you end up picking up the Habs instead?
Time, really. I was born in 1969. So, like, I was, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 in the latter part of the 1970s when the Habs won 4 in a row. So, and, you know, that was back in the day, of course, when we were lucky to have one channel, let alone two, and certainly not any cable television. And so, you know, you watch Tommy Hunter on Saturday night, and then you watch Hockey Night in Canada. And of course, every Saturday night, we just watched hockey. And the Habs were the best team, and they had the cool guys, you know, LaFleur and Gainey and Dryden and all those people. And then, of course, I also fell in love with, the sight of Montreal. I felt like a lot of the other cities kind of looked the same. You know, like, but then you watch Montreal games and everyone's there with fur coats on and everyone's smoking behind the bench. And it just looks like it's an exotic place. And, you know, and this is probably the most disparaging thing to say on a Toronto radio station. But in terms of becoming like a, you know, like the Leafs have never really had a big, massive series against the Habs really in my lifetime. You know, it's like that whole rivalry sort of predated my life, you know, and it's been an interesting time, like you can really have an affinity for both. Like my arch enemy is Boston, for the Habs, you know, but it's interesting.
Yeah, and a lot of Leafs fans of a younger age, their arch enemy is Boston too. It's the way it's gone. And Gretzky robbed us of the 93 Leafs Habs finals. So
and then we bet him.
There you go. So you would have gone to some baby Leafs games when the team was out there in St. John's. Did you ever get to any of those St. John's Edge games when Carl English brought the team there and was playing there?
I did so. Got to see the basketball. I'm a big sports nut, so I go lots of times to the games. And when the baby Leafs were here, one of the coolest things, because I was much younger then. Of course, I was in my late 30s, I suppose, or mid-30s, and I was still playing a lot of hockey myself. I got to be like a goalie in one of their practices. And it was absolutely terrifying, instantly. The distance between a beer league 35-year-old musician goalie and an actual professional athlete is vast and big. And I learned that really quickly.
Man, it's one thing, you know, I'm sure you saw Terry Ryan suited up for one this year, former Habs first round pick who's from Newfoundland. And it's one, and he's an ex-player, and it seemed like it was tough. Can only imagine for you.
Yeah, and TR is actually skilled. Like, he's actually good. I mean, I'm like terrible, so you can only imagine. But all the connections between Newfoundland and Toronto for sports over the years has just been great, you know. And I think it's a great sort of partnership and a great, like, especially when we had the baby Leafs, it felt like we were part of it, you know. And I really loved it.
And I mentioned Carl English there. Just a shout out to his son Ryder, who is here playing in the U-17 Nationals at York University. Oh, his son's big numbers.
I met Ryder and Carl in the airport a little while ago. Now, I met Carl many times, of course, over the years. And what a thrill to have him back in Newfoundland, you know, for his, you know, sort of the last few years of his career. And, he's just like this superstar from here that's been all over the world playing basketball. It's great to have him home. It's amazing.
And now his son looks pretty good, too. Ryder's he's killing it in this under-17 tournament.
Go, pardon buddy, me. Go.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, go, buddy, go. It's fantastic.
Alan, I wanted to go outside of sports with you just for a little bit. So obviously having family in Belle Island and stuff like that, I'm a big Alan Hocko guy, loved Republic of Doyle, like Son of a Critch as well. How did you get hooked up with those guys? How did you kind of get your foot in, you know, making some appearances on Republic of Doyle, doing the music for Son of a Critch?
Well, I've known Alan Hocko and his brother Greg for my whole life, really. I mean, oddly enough, myself and Alan Hocko's older brother, Greg, were the two goalies for our high school hockey team. and myself and Greg played in bands together forever. And he played on the first few Great Big Sea records. And he's now the principal percussionist with Come From Away. And he's amazing. And then, of course, Alan was about, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 years younger than me. I've known his whole life. And then I ended up lucking into a gig doing a film called Robin Hood over in the UK, and because they needed a musician type fella for one of the roles. And I had a little bit of acting experience when my buddies, you know, Alan Hocko and Perry Chafe and those guys all started Republic of Doyle. So then I ended up getting a recurring role in that show, and like it all just sort of one thing led to another.
And then, I mean, I know you're friends with Russell Crowe and stuff like that. How does it end up where Oscar Isaac from that acting world ends up co-writing on your newest album, Welcome Home?
Well, I met Oscar on the set of Robin Hood because he played King John in that film. And he's an incredible musician as well. And I think he used to hear me shagging with my little computer recording setup in my trailer. And we became fast friends, just learning, you know, to make music and learning to record music in mobile and weird places. And right after Robin Hood was over, he had a film called 10 Year, where he played a rock star returning to a high school reunion, and he was to sing a big song in the show, and he wanted to write it. So he called me one night, and we wrote this song called The Best I Never Had, and it made it into the movie, and off we went.
Oh, that's great. It's fun to hear that collaboration, fun to hear those songs. Alan, before I let you go here, you're here on Saturday at Budweiser Stage, big old kitchen party. I know you're performing at home in St. John's in a couple weeks here as well on August 16th. And then you've got a few nights at the Shore Club in Hubbards, Nova Scotia. I know that's a big one to you. What are you looking forward to about this run of shows here?
Oh, it's the summer festival, you know, dance, and it's the greatest thing because we get to see the other bands. And, you know, between myself and Joel Plaskett and the East Pointers this weekend, we'll be doing a bunch of, you know, songs that people love from the Great Big Sea catalog and songs from the Newfoundland traditional catalog and a bunch of my own stuff, all designed to make the greatest kitchen party in the history of Ontario.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, Alan. Really excited to be there on Saturday. Awesome to get to chat with you. And let me know if you end up at that Jays game tomorrow.
I will, so for sure. Thanks so much.
Alan Doyle, it's Budweiser Stage on Saturday. Should be a lot of fun. Joel Plaskett, Emergency, playing as well. Tom Power of Q hosting that event. The album is called Welcome Home. It's Alan's 20th album over 30 years doing music. What a career he's had. And you can go to alandoyle.ca for more on the tour dates and the album and things like that. Right now, we'll take a break. We'll take it back to baseball after the break. We'll go down to Buffalo. Doug Fox almost said Alan Doyle. I don't think Alan Doyle was in Buffalo yesterday. He's in St. John's. He told us that. Doug Fox, who is our favorite Blue Jays prospect guy of the Future Blue Jays newsletter, does a great job covering the minor league system, you know, watching on MILB TV, looking at the stats, talking to people in the organization and things like that, trying to put a lot of video behind the scouting. Well, it's a little different when you get to go down. And by the way, there's a rainout the day before, so you get a doubleheader. And as a little bonus, you get to watch Joey Votto in one of those games. We'll take a break. We'll talk to Doug Fox on the other side. Check in with these Buffalo Bisons. Check in around the Blue Jays farm system. And then, hey, while we're down in Buffalo, while we're talking Blue Jays farm system, Will Wagner, who the Blue Jays acquired at the trade deadline as part of the Yusei Kikuchi package, he'll join us in this next segment as well around 11:15. So stick with us. All that's next on Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Fun one there talking to Alan Doyle for a little bit, who's a big, big sports fan. Maybe you'll see him down at the Jays game tomorrow. I was watching the game on TV yesterday, and there was a guy who vaguely looked like me in one of the behind the home plate seats. It was really, really throwing me off. Jays lose yesterday. We got a couple texts in the text line. Probably won't get to do a ton of it today because we've got five guests today, but we'll do a bunch more of it tomorrow. You can always text us 590, 590. Standard data and message rates may apply. I think this was a response to something Caitlin said. Other than the recent deadline, name a few good trades that Ross has made. I think the case you'd make is that, with the exception of the Moreno for Varsho trade, the prospects they've traded away for a guy like Matt Chapman, a guy like Jose Berríos, those have been fine. Like the Berríos one is a win-win. Simeon Woods Richardson has turned into a good player. Austin Martin as a bench piece. You're fine with that for Berríos. You know, nothing they gave up in the Matt Chapman trade turned into anything. You know, the Robbie Ray trade, they clearly won. I think that's probably what Caitlin's referring to. I know some people will only look at the Varsho Moreno swap, even after Varsho wins a platinum glove here at some point. Yeah, that's a tougher one as someone who, again, as every listener knows at this point, I like catchers. I love catching prospects, especially the ones who don't work out. But in Gabriel Moreno's case, I could make an exception as well. Someone who I can't read their name said, given Dalton's age and being the top outfielder in baseball, if he could hit 250 with 30 homers and 90 RBI, what kind of contract would he be looking at? I don't know. He'd be like one of the most valuable players in all of baseball. If you were this good defensive, like by wins above replacement, which is imperfect, but let's use it as a rough approximation, him and Vlad are basically equal because the defensive base running is so valuable from Dalton Varsho over the last couple of years. You add on a significantly better hitter than that, you're talking about a huge contract. You're talking about one of the best outfielders in baseball. But I don't think he can hit 250. The 30 home runs, yeah, he hit 27 one year. I could see him, you know, staying hot and getting into 30 home runs at some point in his career. But 250, you know, I don't know if he's going to be that kind of an average, that kind of an on-base guy, really. I think, you know, this is, what are we? We're 5 years in now. I guess he did hit 246 one year, but that was over half of a season. You know, he's probably a low to mid-low 200s guy and with some power there. So, yeah, we'll see how that goes. But it is an interesting hypothetical because he's the best defensive outfielder in baseball by a pretty good margin here. Let's go away from the MLB team. Let's take a look down on the farm. Our next guest is Doug Fox, DMFox705 on Twitter, and of course, author of the Future Blue Jays newsletter. Doug, how we doing, man? Fresh from Buffalo.
Oh, Buffalo was wonderful yesterday. You know, you can look at stats, you can look at box scores, you can even watch games online, but there certainly is no substitute for watching a game in person. And I can't think of a better minor league park, at least in this part of the continent, to watch a game than Salem Field. It was awesome yesterday.
Yeah, I was going to push back if you didn't specify this part of the continent, because we've got the Nat. I know you're wearing the Vancouver Canadiens hat. We got the Nat Bailey Stadium in Vancouver, yep, which is a pretty good
Nat
one, too.
Bailey
there you
in
go.
The background.
There you go. So how was the doubleheader's cool. It's obviously good from a scouting perspective for you to get eyes on, but you talk to a ton of people in this organization to do your newsletter, to do the work you do on Twitter. How was that aspect of it for you yesterday? I'd imagine you were, as far as people on the organization side go, it's like, oh man, Doug Fox is here.
Yesterday I was in attendance as a fan, a longtime friend who is a history professor in Buffalo. At SUNY Buffalo, thanks Andrew. Heads up to shout out to you. He invited me down, and so we took in the game together and reconnected, talked baseball. And then I started getting messages from people in the Bisons organization after the game. Oh, why didn't you say hello? And I do feel a little sheepish about that, but it was great to reconnect with a friend. But that's, I think, the thing I like about going to minor league parks the best is that I reconnect with all kinds of people, not just players. But coaches, staff, sometimes the ushers. Vancouver has longtime ushers there on their staff. So that's just a great experience all the way around. And it's great to get to the park, say, 2 or 3 hours early and just have those conversations with people. And you learn so much, and it just enhances your experience.
Yeah, which, you know, that this is part of what goes into making your newsletter so good. And it's also just a fun thing from a fan perspective. So you mentioned, you know, you can look at MILB TV and you can look at the stat line, you can talk to people, even there as a fan for two games, how much extra do you think you pick up being there in person and being there up close?
I think you just now I didn't get there for pregame drills, which I really do enjoy because it does give you a sense of what players are working on. But you just you get to see things like Alan Roden taking an extra base yesterday that you might not have seen from the limited camera angles you get from MILB.com and Jonathan Classe ranging far to go for a fly ball that he could have caught but at the last second missed. And you just get a much wider perspective, you know, as anybody would know from watching a game in person. But it's in the in-between as well. You get to see what players are out and working on a few things just before the next game starts.
Yeah, it's interesting with the Class A example. The hey, you can see stuff that didn't happen as well. Whereas if you're, you know, trying to catch up via video, via box score and things like that, you might miss. You only get to see what happened, not what didn't happen and could have. So this is a Bison's team. They split the doubleheader. They're not playing particularly well. When you look at that group as a whole, you chalk that up mostly to how much the Jays have had to pull from that team when it comes to them not playing particularly well of late?
I think it speaks to that. And I also, quite honestly, I think it speaks to the pitching depth or lack thereof in the organization. I believe the Bisons are last or near last in several International League pitching categories and kind of revolving cast of characters. I know pitching coach Drew Hayes has a spreadsheet that's pretty lengthy that he's got to scroll through just to keep track of his guys. And so I think it really speaks to that. There are some decent position players on that team right now, especially since the trade deadline. But it as so much of it comes down to in this game, it's pitching. And the Bison's pitching, they really haven't even had a starting rotation to speak up. You know, Chad Dallas has gone down. Tiedemann has barely been around all season long. You know, those are going to be two big parts, at least in the first half, of their pitching staff. So manager Casey Candel and the farm department have had to have a makeshift rotation and have some bullpen games, and that's really what it comes down to.
And that's how you see Aaron Sanchez pitching 61 and a third innings before getting released the other day. Bo Sulser, guys like that. Before we get into the prospects, this guy is a little old for the level, so maybe we qualify that in some way. How did Joey Votto look?
Joey Votto looked professional. He looked Joey Votto-like. He did get one hit, struck out a couple of times, and you know, we were not right behind home plate, so I couldn't see exactly how they were pitching him, so I don't want to talk about swing decisions or anything like that. He did on his hit, he got down the first baseline really well. Didn't seem to be showing any ill effects of that ankle injury that's bothered him all season. And he looked agile for somebody his age, if I can use that phrase, as somebody who's much older than that. He looked agile at first base. And you have to think, you know, as I was watching yesterday, I wondered, when is his opt-out date kick in? Why is he still doing this? I think what it comes down to is I think Joey still, I know he wants to finish on a high note, but I'm not sure if he's just interested in a September wear the Blue Jays hat and perform in front of the hometown fans. He's pretty dedicated, pretty serious, and you have to think to continue on so far into this season with the obstacles he's had to overcome, you have to wonder if he's still possibly thinking about next year and is he a guy who we should be maybe tucked away in the back of the corner to be thinking about for next year.
Well, I'll need to see it a little bit more before I start thinking about that, but hope his story gets the final or at least next chapter that he's hoping for here. Let's talk about some of the kids in Buffalo. A lot of new faces there because guys have gotten promoted from AA. The Blue Jays made a bunch of trades. Obviously, I want to start with one guy who has been there for a little bit. So Alan Roden, maybe not the last time we talked, but before that, he had been killing it in AA, and we were kind of like, when's he going to get the call-up? When's he getting the bump? He got the bump, struggled for the first little bit, but he's really turned it on lately. What are you liking from Alan Roden since he got his feet under him with the Bisons?
Man, there's just so much to like about Alan Roden's game. Just such a high baseball IQ. Perfect example, in the first game, runners at first and second, maybe one out. Don't remember exactly, saw a lot of baseball yesterday. And similar to Addison Barger the other night, on an outside pitch, possibly a breaking ball, rather than trying to pull the ball or letting it go and maybe catching the outside corner, he just reached out and he tapped that ball into left field. Didn't bring in a run, but it kept the inning going, and the Bisons managed to score in that inning. And I thought that was just a great piece of situational hitting, and I think that really sums up Alan Roden. He's told me that the adjustment from AA to AAA stuff-wise was not huge, but in terms of AAA pitchers being able to tunnel their pitches, being able to sequence their pitchers, they're much the word that he uses is they're much more mature. And I think that speaks to, you know, we used to think that the gap between AA and AAA was not that huge, and it wasn't unusual for the odd prospect to come up from AA to the majors. But we, you know, that's becoming rare and rare as the gap even between those two level grows. But he's made the adjustments. He's seeing the ball well. He hustles on every play, whether it's at the bat or in the field. And he's just such a smart player. And As I wrote about in my last newsletter, I think we maybe had for a couple of weeks had kind of written off any chance of seeing him in Toronto in September. But you have to think, again, this is a great time to audition players. And yes, it does involve a roster move since he's not on the 40. But I would not be surprised if he continues at this rate. Would not be surprised to see him in Toronto in September. Just really not a first division player, perhaps. But just a guy who I think is just going to continue to develop as a big leader, may struggle a little bit at first like Barger did, but he looks like a big leaguer, looked like one yesterday.
Yeah, and it's you know, there's a nice little competition brewing on the Bisons team between, you know, him, Will Wagner, Jonathan Classe. You know, hey, if the Jays open up a spot or even if you just look September 1st when the roster expands or whatever, who gets that nod? We'll see. So what have your, I know Class A especially you've seen a lot of because he played in the Northwest League when he was in A ball. But between him and Will Wagner, what have you seen early on from those two? What are you looking for as they kind of get their feet under them here in the Jays organization?
Class A can do a lot of things. He laid down a beautiful bunt early in the game, first or second inning yesterday in the first game, perfectly placed down the third base line. And with the way he gets out of the box as a left-handed hitter, there was no chance to get him. And then a few innings later, hit a home run to a fairly deep part of the ballpark. So he can do that both ways. He ranges a long way for fly balls. Not sure he's going to be replacing Dalton Varsho anytime soon, but there's, you know, his speed is definitely game changing. Wagner didn't see a lot of him from the plate. Was impressed with how he turned a couple of double plays. Really good on that pivot. I know there has been some concern about what position he could play, but second base kind of looks like his home. And as I wrote about, J.P. Ricciardi, guest and friend of your show as well, is now doing some color commentary for the Red Sox AAA team. And I really enjoyed listening to him last week because J.P. at heart is a scout and he really knows how to evaluate a player. And he talked up Wagner quite a bit as somebody who he had watched as a collegian, and he's watched through at the minors and just feels that he gets better at each level. And yes, he's 26 years old, but Some guys bloom late, and he's very much, as you suggest, he's very much in the running maybe from one of those limited expanded roster spots in September. But a very impressive player. Wish I'd seen a little bit more of him from the plate yesterday, but he has produced for Buffalo since joining the organization.
So another new face there that you got two games worth of look at. Josh Kosevich made his debut with the Bisons yesterday, and he was another guy, like with Alan Roden, we talked earlier in the year, and we're kind of like, okay, when is this going to happen? You know, he's 2022 second-round pick for anyone who doesn't remember. So he did a bit of A-ball in 2022, all of last year at high A. Now he's a 23-year-old at double A. He had started the season really well and then cooled off pretty dramatically at the plate, but they've given him the bump regardless. What are you looking for from Kosevich here at the AAA level?
Hitting the ball hard. That's the issue. He was one of the toughest. I think he was the second toughest collegiate player to strike out in his draft year, with a K rate of just under 5%. And he really represents the profile the Blue Jays have been looking for, with mixed success over the last couple of years in the draft, with that hit over power, that contact profile. But he was among the Eastern League leaders in hits and batting average for much of the season. Yes, he did tail off a little bit. He hit a line drive home run yesterday. Once again, it was to the gap, a little bit wind assisted because the wind was blowing out, but it was a decent shot just the same in his first game in Buffalo. And as far as he goes defensively, he's smooth, he's slick, he doesn't make a lot of mistakes at shortstop. So it's really a question of how that bat comes along as to where and when we see him in the big leagues.
On the pitching side, you didn't get a look at him yesterday, but another guy that we had kind of been like, all right, like, let's get the shuffling going so we can see him at the next level. Trenton Wallace, who was dominant at Double A, but, you know, is 25. So you're like, okay, he should be pretty good at Double A at this point. He's gotten the bump. He's only gotten to make one start so far at Triple A. It didn't go super, super well. But what do you like about Trenton Wallace, and where will the challenges be for him at this next level?
Trenton is just a guy who seems, last start, his debut notwithstanding, seems to be a guy who gives you six innings and has only given up a couple of hits and maybe two runs, and he's struck out seven. Doesn't throw hard, but he has an extremely low arm slot, a little bit of deception to his delivery, commands all of his pitches really well. The two issues for him are, number one, he doesn't throw hard, so he's working with a far less margin for error than a lot of other pitchers do. The second one is his ability to get right-handed hitters out. And I know from talking with Blue Jays minor league pitching coordinator Corey Popham earlier in the season, they were really working on him with that changeup to right-handed hitters. So that's the challenge at AAA. May take him a little while. Might be more of a guy, even though he doesn't throw hard, just maybe I think with his ability to throw strikes, that maybe we see one day more as a situational lefty. But he's got more starts. He's done well at every level, and let's see how he figures things out in his next couple of starts.
Staying on the pitching side, but let's leave Buffalo and go a little lower in the minors here. You had an update in your newsletter. What's the latest on Adam Macko for anyone who missed that? We haven't seen him pitch in a couple weeks here.
So talk to somebody in the Blue Jays organization, and you know, they're understandably the Blue Jays are really hesitant to divulge much in the way of injury related information, and it seems to come through John Schneider. That seems to be their preferred method, either updating reporters in a media availability, or sometimes I ask our good friend Keegan Matheson if he wouldn't mind asking. And so he had asked, I believe it was July 27th, he asked, and Schneider said that Macko was starting a throwing progression in Florida and was hoping to ramp up to get back into pitching before the end of the season. Spoke with somebody else in the Blue Jays organization very recently, and he was not as enthused. And it was all I can say is that he's still in Florida. So read into that what you will. I guess you could also say, with limited time in the minor league season left, is there really a need to rush Macko? He has not missed a start up until this season in a year and a half with the Blue Jays. And maybe this is just some maintenance, but I mean, we know we've been down this road before with several other pitchers. So I am a little bit concerned, and I won't be surprised if Macko is shut down for the rest of the season as a result.
When it comes to pitchers who are actually healthy and pitching, there's not a lot on the top prospect side. There's some relievers, some org depth guys. Would it be like, would we have to go down as far as Kendry Rojas and Fernando Perez for like the top pitching prospects who are healthy and pitching right now?
Yeah. Those I said they are the top two healthy pitching prospects and probably in the organization right now. Rojas has missed a good chunk of the season as well, and his development has been put back a little bit. Wonder if this is the time of year we begin to wonder if we see guys in the Arizona Fall League, and I wonder if he's a guy who might get that invitation to get some extra innings. Good-looking left-handed reliever, throws four pitches for strikes. Northwest League hitters have largely been overmatched against him in the outings that I've seen. So I suspect we might see him at Double-A before the end of the year. Fernando Perez, last two starts have been kind of funky. He was taken out of his next-to-last start.
Was that the heat exhaustion one?
That seems to be what people in the organization were thinking, because he didn't, like, there weren't any obvious signs of pain, didn't point to his arm, didn't, you know.
Made his next start.
Made his next start, but then manager Jose Mayorga came out to get him very suddenly And I don't think they even had anybody warming up at the time, and haven't heard anything since then. But you have to wonder about that. They might also just be protecting, and this is his first full season, and that young arm has thrown a lot of pitches, and perhaps we're just erring on the side of caution. But he's 19 or 20 years old and is already throwing in the mid-90s. And I have no doubt when the top prospect rankings for the Florida State League come out very soon that I'm sure he will be among those top prospects. So maybe this is just cautionary at the time. But, I mean, we look down the list of Blue Jays pitching prospects and injured, came back, shut down for a while. It's also an industry-wide problem, as Mark Shapiro mentioned yesterday. So I know the Blue Jays are the sports science people and the player development people are trying to put their heads together to come up with a solution to this. But all I can say is for the third round pick, Johnny King, protect him, please, at all costs.
Yeah, and we don't know. Are we going to see Treya Savage and Cal Steven much down the stretch? It sounded like from Shane Farrell that, you know, given the college innings and things like that, if we see him, it'll be briefly. But of the other new imports via trade or via the draft who have been assigned to a level so far, is there anyone you're most excited to get a look at or have already gotten a look at and are excited by?
Wasn't drafted, but came with a trade deadline and is already a fan, favorite in Vancouver, is catcher Jacob Sharp. A little guy, but he's stout, and he has some bat speed, and he's had a very impressive debut. Dunedin has had several college guys already come into their lineup, the old Argo Airlift, as I call it, for 1970s CFL fans. I looked at the lineup they fielded last night, and that was quite different. They had a whole bunch of the draftees in there. So nobody yet. Carter Cunningham had a decent debut, a couple of hits. Aaron Parker hit a home run either in his first game or his first at-bat. So it's exciting to see those guys get into action. But, yeah, as far as the top two choices go, I suspect we won't see them at all. Florida Complex League is over, and at this point there's not a lot of reason. You're not really accomplishing anything by having a Savage pitch against low-A hitters, to be honest. And I'm sure that they would prefer to keep those guys at the Complex on their training programs, send them with a training program for the offseason. Let's see what happens next year.
And this is why we can't use the Verducci rule anymore, because there's so much. I mean, it was never that statistically relevant anyway, but now there's so much going on the developmental list that we can't really get a hand on. Last one before I let you go here. You got the Desaun Brown to Double-A promotion you'd been asking for. With Desaun, you know, it had been coming for a while, and then he got hurt for a little bit, and you know the Canadians needed him there or whatever. Desaun Brown, a Canadian prospect, one of the only guys in the org, well, now Jonathan Classe, but one of the best set of wheels in the entire organization. And Desaun Brown, excited to see him with New Hampshire and see if he can make that jump after a kind of stop and start high A career.
Very, very excited. He first off, he has a joy for the game that's very similar to Stuart Baroa's. Desaun is always smiling out there. I'm so glad to see this. And once again, having talked about late bloomers earlier, maybe this is a late bloomer as well. Maybe this is a guy who's going to take almost 6 years before he hits minor league free agency, before we start to see something. But he has game-changing speed. One of the fastest guys in the minor leagues, a fine defensive player, and he's going to be matched. He's possibly even at first going to be overmatched, and I wouldn't be surprised if he struggles a little bit at first. But I think he's also, since about June of this year, there's just been a difference in the quality of contact that he's been making and in the at-bats that he's been making. So I'm really excited to see him in the Fisher Cats lineup. Fisher Cats could use a player to be excited about, because the team has not been worth writing home about this year.
And, I mean, yeah, they keep losing guys to AAA, which is a part of it. It's the nature of it. But, yeah, nice to see them get some additions as well. Doug, nice to see you. Glad you had a great trip down to Buffalo. Thanks for taking the time out.
Blake, great t-shirt, by the way. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Doug Fox. It's DMFox705 on Twitter. It's the Future Blue Jays newsletter. Wherever you subscribe to newsletters, Beehive is the site, but you can just go to Doug's Twitter, DMFox705, and find a link from there. Let's keep it with the minor leagues. Let's keep it with the Buffalo Bisons. Let's welcome our next guest, one of the newest players in the Toronto Blue Jays organization, came over from Houston at the trade deadline, joined now by Will Wagner. Will, how's it going, man?
Doing good. How are you guys doing?
Pretty well, man. So how's the adjustment been so far? I know at the plate, the answer is pretty clearly you're adjusting just fine. How's it been moving over to the Jays org and to Buffalo?
Definitely different. It's a big change from Texas for sure. I was in Sugar Land and it was really hot and you just go out and break a sweat, and now you're here in Buffalo and it's a little bit chillier. So definitely a different change from the weather standpoint, but baseball is baseball, so that's the same still.
Yeah, and I like the Bison's uniform, but you went from, like, the Space Cowboys. Like, you went from the team with maybe the coolest minor league uniform and hats in the league to a little more plain one, I'd imagine. Did you, like, stock up on Space Cowboys gear before you took off?
Oh, yeah. I know I have a bunch of stuff. I have so much extra stuff I was starting to give away to some of my teammates, and then just so much extra stuff, and then my fiance Brooke has a bunch of the Space Cowboys stuff still. My brothers and sisters still have a lot, so it's still in the family.
Nice. So you come over, and obviously I'd imagine this is quite a whirlwind in a lot of ways, even if the baseball is still the baseball. You join a team where you get a college teammate on that team, and Mason Fluardi. How much has that helped with the transition early on here?
Flu's awesome. He's helped me so much. He's just told me places to go eat and then, like, showed me around the field how to get there and stuff. He's just been a great teammate, a great friend.
You show up in Buffalo, and again, the baseball side's a baseball side. Pretty cool to look across the clubhouse and Joey Votto's in there, or what?
Oh, yeah. The first road trip, Joey's pretty much my locker mate. He's right beside me, and we talked a good amount. And it's funny, the first conversation we had is about him facing my dad, so that was pretty cool.
Nice. I guess that shows how long Joey Votto's been around for. Have you gotten to the point yet? Are you picking his brain on stuff, and, you know, especially when it comes to hitting and the approach side of things, or is it a little early for that still?
A little bit. I know he talks about it, like, with a lot of the guys, and you're just there just soaking it in for the most part, but also he's I'm trying to just watch him afar and not get too annoying to him.
I'm sure he knows and appreciates it. So the trade itself, first of all, it happens on your birthday, no less. How did you find out about it? What was your initial reaction to the news you'd been dealt?
Honestly, I found out from Flu.
Nice.
I wasn't really expected to be traded at all. All week we were just going through scenarios because one of my best friends with the Astros org was tearing it up, and I was like, all right, you're getting traded for sure. Like, there's no shot I'm getting traded. And then me and him were playing video games, and Blue texts me and goes, hey, I just woke up from my coach is texting me about you. Are you in this deal? And I was like, nah, no shot I'm in that deal. And then 20 minutes later, I get a call from our GM saying, oh, we just traded you. So it was like kind of just so weird because I kind of blacked out when he called me. I was like, there's no way I just got traded. I never imagined myself not playing for the Astros and stuff. So it was just weird to adjust to for sure.
Was the teammate Zach DiCenzo who's up with the Astros now?
No, it was Shea Whitcomb.
Oh, okay. I heard you say a red hot hitter, the Triple A Astros. It was either you or DiCenzo or Whitcomb. So pretty good chance there. Okay. So when you find out, it is you in the deal and it's going to be the Blue Jays organization. Did you know much about the Jays organization? Obviously, I'd imagine, again, Mason Fluardi, a helpful resource there. But that part of it for you, that you're coming to Toronto, you're coming to the Jays org. What did you think of that?
I knew a little bit. I mean, I know about the Blue Jays for sure. I didn't know about the org itself and how different it could be from the Astros. But I know Vladdy. I know Bo Bichette. I like watching Bo's swing and how he adjusts. I take his swing and apply it to mine a lot too. So, I mean, I know the players, but getting to the org, it was just definitely an adjustment for sure.
do you have an awareness? Like you mentioned Bo Bichette there, the Jays have had Kevin Biggio and Dalton Varsho and Vlad. And you know, there it's like a bit of a running joke that the Jays really like players who have that kind of family roots in the game. And obviously your dad was a very, very good major leaguer. Were you aware of that aspect of it?
Yeah, I was. I know Biggio because I talked to Craig Biggio a little bit when I was with the Astros during spring training and stuff. So I know his son, and he used to play for the Blue Jays and stuff. So that's pretty cool.
What do you think it is that, you know, whether it's the Jays or whatever, but like obviously there's a genetic component to it. Your dad's a good baseball player and you pick some of that up. What do you think it is about that beyond that, though? You know, like I'd imagine you were around ballparks a lot as a kid. You took to it very young. What things that make guys like you and Kevin and Bo and other guys who, you know, have parents in the game, so, you know, I don't know, just that ease in picking it up.
I just think it's the understanding of baseball and like the IQ behind it. I think we're brought into a clubhouse very young, and we get to watch pro baseball players, the best to do it at a very young age. So you kind of get used to it early and it grows on you and you get mature at a young age. So now, like, picking up baseball and, like, the IQ is easy at this point.
Yeah, that seems to make sense. So you mentioned you're around the park a little bit. Your dad would have retired when you were, I think, 12-ish. But that's yes. That's old enough. Do you have any kind of favorite memories of being around the ballpark as a kid?
Yeah, I don't really remember too much when he was with the Astros. But when he was with the Phillies, I just remember being in the clubhouse all the time and just being around all the guys. There was a time where my dad took me at Wrigley Field and I was hitting BP on the field and Sammy Sosa came on the field and said hi to us. So that was pretty cool.
Nice. That would be, hitting BP with Sammy Sosa nearby. Pretty cool. I know your younger brother's in high school on a team that your dad's coaching, just like he coached you. How's he doing? Are you able to kind of, you know, keep up on how he's doing with his high school and obviously advance beyond that as prep for college?
Yeah, for sure. I keep up with him all the time. I think he's in between pitching and hitting right now, but I think he's leaning towards being a pitcher. He's been shoving on the mound for them. So I've been keeping up with him. He's got a few college calls right now that he's doing. He's in that process. So it's looking good for him.
Back on to the U side of things and the Jays side of things. What has the communication been like since they picked you up, you know, your intake with Buffalo or whatever? Like, are they talking to you about, hey, we like this about you. Hey, we see this area for you to develop and improve? Or is it kind of just like, hey, come get your feet under you for a while first?
A little bit of both. I mean, when I was with Sugarland, I played first and second a lot. And now I'm starting to move to like just second and a little bit of third. But it's definitely a different little process. I think they just want to see me play. I've only played in a few games here. So I think they just want to give me a little bit longer to get my feet under me.
What is, like, do you have a comfort level at one position over the other? I know you've played all four infield positions over the course of your minor league career so far. Is there one that, you know, you feel you're best at or most comfortable at?
Right now, I think I like second a lot just because played 4 years in college at second base. I didn't really play any other positions. And I just felt really comfortable at second lately.
I know you pitched a little bit in the minors as well in an emergency situation. If you were putting a resume together or something like that, are you including, hey, emergency pitcher on it as well?
Probably not, no. That whole situation was crazy because that was very unexpected when I went into the game.
Okay, man. So you're at AAA now. Obviously you've been raking this year. We look back a couple years ago and you were an 18th round pick despite, you know, the pedigree and good numbers in college and things like that. How has that journey been like for you from, you know, 18th round pick is pretty slept on for a guy to be able to get to AAA and be a key piece in a trade. How do you think being drafted in that area has kind of motivated you or kind of been a part of this story for you getting to this level?
It's kind of just like a chip on my shoulder. It just keeps me motivated and humble at the same time. I think it was the first year of 20 rounds too, so I understand how complicated the draft could have been. But draft day was kind of like miserable for me just because I've heard so many things. And then there was a point where I didn't think I was going to get drafted. And my baseball career was going to be over. So it was a really like a roller coaster of a time there. And then me just getting drafted, I'm just so thankful for getting drafted. So then again, I'm just humbled that the Astros drafted me, and then I just wanted to show them that I was worth the draft pick and that I gave them my all.
So what do you think's gone into the success you're having this year at the plate? Obviously, the scouting report on you has been that you've been a good hitter level after level. You get a little taste of it, of AAA last season, but, you know, you were hitting like over 300 with, I think, like an 850 OPS at AAA before the trade. What do you think's clicked or come together for you as a hitter over the last little while?
I would just say my approach at the plate. I feel like I'm a patient hitter, and I like to look for my pitch a lot. I think that fixes in the walks I got this year. And I think just not being upset with getting walked. I think getting walked is one of the best things in baseball you can do, because then you make the pitcher throw a pitch that you want to hit, and when you get it, you can drive it.
Is that a tough thing to like convince yourself of, though? Because I'd imagine, like, obviously, like you said, walk is a good outcome, right? Especially you're walking way more this year than you're striking out and things like that. But you probably want to swing the, you go up there wanting to swing the bat, right?
Yes, for sure. I think, earlier this year I was struggling hitting wise, but I was walking a lot, and I had to keep telling myself that the walks are good, because when I start getting hot again, that average will jump. And it certainly did. And I think, when you keep getting walked, it means you're seeing the ball well. And then when that pitch does come, that you won't miss it.
And so when it comes to that, how much of that, and like you've had low chase rates at every level that we have the numbers for and things like that. Do you think that, like, does that feel like a pretty innate thing to you? Like it's pretty natural, or are you, you know, really studying these pitchers? What goes into having that good approach and plate discipline for you?
Definitely studying the pitchers, just having an approach, but not trying to overcomplicate it. Just go in there with an approach and stick with it. And I know, like, a bat to a bat's going to change a little bit, because the reports aren't for, it's for everyone. It's not just for you. So if you go in your first at bat looking for fastball and you only get off-speed pitches, and then your second at bat, you might want to change it to, like, okay, let's sit soft, and then with two strikes, we'll just adjust to it again. But it's just a bat-to-bat changing your approach and whatever you can do there to compete a little bit.
All right. And I mentioned it off the top. You're off to a pretty good start with Buffalo. I know you're a humble guy, so you probably won't say much. But you 9 for 18 with four walks in just five games here. Man, you feeling pretty good at the plate, pretty locked in right now, even though it's a new environment and a new team and everything?
Yeah, I feel really good. I think that first week I was really nervous to play, just to prove that, like, the trade wasn't a waste from my end of the deal, and that I'm actually somewhat good. I wanted to show something. So I was really nervous those first couple of games, just wanted to prove something. And then I settled in after that first game for sure when I got that first hit out of the way.
Looking ahead a little bit, have you been to Toronto before?
Never been to Toronto, no.
All right, man. Well, looking forward to it in a little bit here, maybe. Best of luck the rest of the way here, man. Thanks for taking the time out.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Will Wagner, Buffalo Bisons, second baseman / we'll see, third base, shortstop, first base. Yeah, it doesn't sound like he wants to pitch an emergency situation again. But yeah, off to a really good start here. 9 for 18, four walks. He's homered already, couple extra base hits. And yeah, the AAA numbers all year, really, even in Houston, stand out. A lot more walks than strikeouts, some power there. Everyone you talk to on the scouting side seems to believe in the bat, whether that's, you know, what the role eventually ends up being. We'll see. And just turned 26 on the day he got traded. So, you think that means he's probably fairly near to the major leagues. Maybe we get a look at him down the stretch here with the Toronto Blue Jays, whether that's, changing something out, waiting for September 1st. However it works out, someone on that Bisons team will be up. I guess technically Bo Bichette could just be healthy by September 1st, but it sounds like the team is aiming more, well, if he gets back this year, that would be nice. We'll see how it goes. But rooting for Will Wagner, rooting for a lot of those Bisons guys to turn it around. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Michael Bauman of Fangraphs. We'll go all over the place. We'll talk a little bit about a White Sox team that just fired their general manager. We'll talk, their manager, not their general manager. We'll talk about what it means to be clutch in 2024, because Fangraphs has a clutch statistic, and I think you guys might be a little surprised at which Blue Jay tops the list in all of Major League Baseball in terms of clutch hitting. Now, that's some of that's how we define it as well. And then Michael Bauman does weird stuff that scratches a funny itch in my brain. He went looking for the most average player in all of baseball today at Fangraphs. We'll talk about all of that with Michael. We'll tee you up for Dean Kramer against Kevin Gausman tonight, the series finale between the Jays and Orioles as well. All of that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays drop 1-7-3 last night. They'll wrap it up tonight with a 7:07 start again down at Rogers Center. Kevin Gausman against Dean Kramer. We'll tee that one up in a little bit. But right now, let's bring in our pal Michael Bauman of Fangraphs. Michael, how we doing, man? I have not got to read the article yet this morning because it came out during the show. But I am very, very excited to dig in on who is the most average player in the league. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm pretty good, man. I'm excited to read that piece. I want to start outside of that one, though, and we'll get back there, I promise. I know you are pretty locked in on the Olympics as well. How are you enjoying it? And what is your niche event in the Olympics? Not that you'd be good at, because I don't think either of us would be good at most of the things, but the one that like you're really outlier locked in on during the Olympics and making sure you get to watch.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked that question, because in addition to writing about baseball, I have a cycling newsletter at wheeliesports.substack.com. So cycling, particularly the road events, has been a big focus of mine, and I've been writing about it. We're very excited about Kristen Faulkner and her two gold medals down here in the U.S. So that's a big one. Swimming's the other one, too. That's always been an interest of mine. But, you know, now we're just into the boring stuff. It always seems like the last week of the Olympics is a bit of a letdown after swimming and cycling are over, and gymnastics too.
How do you feel about the track cycling? Like, the track cycling is on right now with like the slanted, mm-hmm. like you're almost in a bowl. It looks like they're like it's a roulette wheel, and all the wheels are racing, all the balls are racing around in the wheel. Do you enjoy that one too? And like, how different is that than the type of cycling you normally cover?
Yeah, it's very different from road racing. You will see some of the same athletes, like for instance, half of the American team pursuit team that won gold has already medaled in road events these Olympics. So there is some crossover, but it's a very different sport. It's all like there's less tactics. It's all like technique and pure power and stuff. So I guess like in a lot of cases, track cycling is more the purest event, and road cycling is, you know, a little more strategic.
Huh. It's interesting. I don't have a good pivot back to baseball from there. Yeah, so we'll just hard pivot. Jays are playing the Orioles right now. So I did want to ask you, I know that, you know, trade deadline's a week and a half behind, but you did write up the Eloy Jimenez acquisition for the Orioles with a sick transit Eloy title. You know, Eloy Genius was right there. You could have gone an Eloy Genius reference mm-hmm. as well. In seriousness, though, that addition for the Orioles, given how lefty heavy they skewed and the need for an extra right-handed bat there, I know it's not been the best of years for Eloy, but did you like that move for Baltimore?
I think it all depends on what they do with him this offseason, because the contract that we thought was going to be a bargain for the White Sox and last forever has turned out to do neither. Like, he's got those expensive option years coming up. So, and the Orioles are not exactly hurting for sort of youngish outfield DH power. So I'm interested to see what they do with that option. I think, you know, there's a possibility he serves as a useful right-handed bench bat down the stretch for them. But I think that this is mostly about, in my mind, this makes sense for the Orioles if they think there's something about him they can fix. And the Orioles have a very good reputation for teaching hitting mechanics and fixing guys with holes in their swings. I mentioned this in my write-up, I think, but their first-round draft pick, Vance Honeycutt, is a guy I wouldn't have touched with a 10-foot pole just because he strikes out so much. But apparently there's a sense within the industry that the Orioles see something in him that, and, you know, if he stops striking out, he could be a superstar. So if they have something in mind specifically with Eloy Jimenez, I think this makes sense. Otherwise, I think this might just be a case of, you know, a bigger name than there is impact, and sort of a coda on a pretty depressing era of White Sox baseball.
If he could stop striking out so much, he could be X. Is like, this is in basketball. Oh, if he could hit a three, if he just learns to hit a three, like, okay, well, there's like nine guys who have done that. So
you understand why I would never in a million years have drafted him. But, you know, the Orioles think they, yeah, and they have a good track record with doing this. So best of luck to them, I guess.
Yeah. And again, Eloy has that $16.5 million club option for this offseason with a $3 million buyout, and then an $18.5 million for the following year with a $3 million buyout. So like almost a $20 million decision for the Orioles this offseason. And then I guess where my interest turns with Eloy is if they don't pick up that option, as much as he's not that great, kind of floats high on the left field / DH free agent list then, I guess, as like, I don't think it would be a buy low because the name value is there, but, you know, not coming off the best of years, maybe he becomes an interesting free agent guy then.
Yeah, definitely. And guys with that kind of name value who showed the talent that he showed, even if it is a few years in the past, that's catnip to GMs. You know, they all think they're the smartest guy in the room. And you know, it's being a GM of a pro sports team is I can fix him, you know, 80 hours a week. So yes, yeah, so I'm interested. Maybe the Orioles can do something where they sort of negotiate an extension lower than the value of his club option. But if that doesn't happen, then I think he will stand to make more than the $3 million buyout this way.
So the other side of that trade is the White Sox trade. They just lost 21 games in a row. They did not have as aggressive a trade deadline as people expected. They just let Pedro Grifol go this morning as their manager. What do you make of where they are, man? Like, I could tell in reading the Eloy piece that was mostly Orioles focus. You were just like, I don't know, man. It's the White Sox. How do we, like, it's hard to do sharp analysis when, like, I don't know, if you take an Econ 101 class, right? Like, the assumption is always, well, everyone's a rational actor and we'll evaluate economics based on that.
Yeah.
But everyone's not a rational actor and not every organization is rational in baseball. What do you make of where they are, the deadline they've had? And I mean, they can't even pick in the top nine this year because of the draft lottery rules. Like, it's a mess there, man.
Yeah. And, you know, what's the expression of fish rots from the head? Like, that's the problems all go upstairs to Jerry Reinsdorf. And we see a lot of the, even down to the hiring process, you know, Chris Getz has never for a second not looked in over his head. And that's not to say that he could not, in the right situation, have been a good GM or a good baseball ops head. This is just, it's one of the toughest jobs in baseball because you have to manage up in a big market on a shoestring budget, and you're getting interfered with constantly, undermined. It's, you know, it's a hospital pass for anybody who would want that job. And I would expect, you know, I don't know who would want to manage the White Sox, considering how dysfunctional that organization has been. Like, if they, you know, I thought they were going to be bad. I was sort of, just from a morbid curiosity perspective, hoping they would be like 115 losses bad. And it could be even worse than that. And, you know, if they break the all-time losses record, which seems like it's a possibility, like, they're going to earn it. This is not, you know, a team that got unlucky or had good process. This was a team that has completely dismantled a contender and gone from, you know, 69 Mets to 62 Mets in less than 5 years.
Yeah, and like, you could point to Yoan Moncada being hurt, and okay, but like, the other pieces who are hurt are either not that good or, and like, in Moncada's case, like, you got a plan as if he's going to be hurt. He was hurt coming into the year, like, you know that a little bit. It's and they're losing this much even with Andrew Benintendi showing signs of life for the first time in several years. So I don't know, man. I don't know. I guess here's where I will end the White Sox part of this conversation for you. Is it more amusing to you if they continue on and they're very, like, historically bad from here, or if they somehow get an unlikely dead cat bounce from letting Pedro Grifol go, and this very, very bad team has like a decent close to the season?
I think I just tweeted this before I came on. I said it's going to be close, but I think it would be funnier if they manage, and particularly if they get like a really funny interim manager, like they bring Ozzie Guillen out of retirement and they go 500 for the rest of the year, than if they break the all-time losses record. But it would be close. I think either one will be very, very interesting to watch.
Okay, let's talk about actual baseball teams that are good. You've had a lot of really great pieces up, which is par for the course, but I have too long a list of things I want to ask you. So let's start with the one that came out today, which is your search for the most average player in all of baseball. What made you want to do that? And I don't know, you can give the answer away if you'd like, but how did we go about finding who the most average player, without doing 20 minutes of standard deviation talk, how did we find the most average player in baseball?
So, I mean, this started with, like most of my articles do, it was like 11:30 in the morning and I knew I had to write something and I was just clicking around the leaderboards. And I said, well, let's go for the middle today instead of like trying to, like the other day I wrote about Ketel Marte, who's having an incredible season. Let's try to find whoever's in the middle. So I thought about the three things that a position player has to do, and that's offense, defense, and base running. And I added in win probability because I've been writing about the clutch aspect, which I think is the other thing you want to talk about. And I tried to find someone who's as close to average as possible in all four of those categories among position players with 200 or more plate appearances. So like, you know, people who've been getting fairly regular playing time, because I don't want the sample to be skewed by guys who played five games or guys who've been hurt all year. And I narrowed that down to people who were within a third of a standard deviation from the median in all four categories. I found three of them, one of whom was Jesus Sanchez, the Marlins outfielder. And then I was like, one of the other guys on the list was Davis Schneider, who, as you know, is near and dear to my heart, being a, you know, a fellow Eastern High School of New Jersey graduate. And he doesn't feel normal to me. He's a short guy with very tight pants, with very, you know, distinctive physical features and a very distinctive offensive approach. So I thought, well, let's add in age and height and weight. And so Sanchez was still within the parameters had to be a little bit wider just to keep everybody, or, you know, keep me from narrowing the field down too far. But he was one of the three last men standing when you incorporated those things. And, you know, I even zoomed out a little bit more and added in, batted ball characteristics. So spray chart stuff, ground ball, fly ball ratio, strikeout and walk ratio. And he was not within that sort of very narrow middle band for all those, but he was very close. And so Jesus Sanchez, and also just, it's a great baseball name.
Yeah.
You just think of it, you know, Jesus Sanchez is like, that's a ball player name. You know, one of the other guys who showed up on my list, or two of them, were Austin Hayes and Colt Keith. Like, you know, those are guys, if they're not going to play baseball for a living, I don't know what they're going to do for a living. So, you know, these are the people I'm holding up this year as the averagest position players in baseball this year.
Well, we'll see if Davis Schneider can get back on that list. He can't with the physical attributes, but, you know, maybe you hit a little bit, the defense comes up a little bit, you get back into that average tier there. Okay, so you referenced that piece on clutch, and, you know, the clutch conversation is funny. You know, just over time, like, there is clutch, there isn't clutch, how do we measure clutch? You know, is David Ortiz actually clutch, or is he just really, really good and happened to play for a team that was in big moments? It's fun to have these conversations. And then you guys at FanGraphs measure clutch. There are a couple of different ways to measure it. It's performance in high leverage situations, or how much better are you in those big situations? And through that metric, there's a pretty surprising top most clutch guy, or guy who turns it on the most when the leverage is highest. Were you surprised to see Dalton Varsho at the top of that list?
I don't know what I thought. I'm not really sure what I was expecting going into that. I think the only names on that top 15 list that I was like, okay, that makes sense, were Corey Seager and Bryson Stott. Like, those are guys who've, like, Seager from a really, really high base level in particular, but those are guys who I've seen in person really elevate their games in the playoffs. So Varsho, like, it might as well be him. It might, you know, it, part, but part of the thing that I was trying to get at is that, you know, my stance has always been that while clutch is something you can absolutely quantify and measure, you could do it very, very easily. Looking back, in a clutch situation where I don't know the outcome, I would rather have a better hitter in all contexts than a guy who supposedly elevates his game in the clutch, because it's not, you know, it's not something that's durable year over year for most people. You know, maybe there are special guys like, you know, like Seager, like David Ortiz, like you mentioned, but those guys are like once in a generation and also tend to be pretty good hitters to begin with. And so,
and to put it in context here, like the way you frame it, I don't know if you use this exact 1v1, but like, yeah, Dalton Varsho has 27 plate appearances that are high leverage this year. He has almost a 1.5 OPS in those. Somehow he never strikes out. He's just been very, very good in those high leverage spots. And then one of the worst players in those situations league-wide has been Bryce Harper. Yeah. Ask every person in baseball, big opportunity, big plate appearance, would you rather have Dalton Varsho up or Bryce Harper? I can't imagine anyone's not picking Bryce Harper, right?
And particularly because, and I didn't know this going in when I, you know, made this argument, it was just something that sort of fell into my lap. If you look at that clutch metric, the like number one leader in the league in among qualified hitters last year was Bryce Harper. He was the most clutch player in the league in 2023. And now he's hitting one. I haven't seen how he's done taking the last few nights of games into account. But when I wrote it, he was hitting like, I think it was like 153, 20, 180 in high leverage situations this season. And it's mystifying because you think Harper is one of those guys that you think of as, you know, how many big playoff hits has he had? So it just illustrates the point that, you know, you can go back and make an argument about a clutch, or Ben Clemens, who's way better at the quantitative stuff than I am. He wrote a companion piece about momentum that went up today. You can go back and fill in the narrative looking back on it. I think that's an important part of baseball analysis, and important, particularly if you're a writer with any pretensions of like, you know, literary ability. You have to go back and fill in that narrative. But in terms of predicting the future, clutch is not something that tends to carry over. It's sort of like the hot hand in basketball in that respect.
It is descriptive, not predictive.
Yes.
Is the exactly. And then a hot hand in basketball, we get into all sorts of weird stuff. We're like, well, then you get a better defender guarding you, and then you can get double teamed and stuff like that. You can't quite do that in baseball. Right. I don't think you can double team a guy in baseball. Although the Jays just spent an entire weekend intentionally walking Aaron Judge with nobody on and two out. So maybe you can effectively double team. Last thought on the clutch pieces. So the question, you know, the question you're trying to get at there is kind of, would you rather have a mediocre player who is very, very clutch, or a very, very good player who isn't clutch? And the answer is actually, in either case, you would just take Jurickson Profar, the one guy who has been able to do both this year as a surprise.
Yeah, that's the I think I said, like, he's the baseball gods have blessed him this year. He's just having an incredible season in all categories. So the answer is definitely, you know, do you want Bryce Harper or Dalton Varsho? No, you want Jurickson Profar.
Yeah, that's in all cases. I think he was the only guy that came in the top 15 in overall and in clutch. Really quickly before we let you go here, Michael, you also had a piece on whether managers use their relievers in the best situations. And obviously the save situation is the way guys have managed before. Now we tend to look at it more as leverage index and, you know, like how big a leverage spot is this? Seventh inning, bases loaded, heart of the order is probably a bigger spot than ninth inning, bases empty, bottom of the order. You did a great job explaining and breaking it all down. Do you think this is our best way to evaluate managers of the data that's available to us? Obviously it's a fickle thing to try to do, but one of the ways we can gauge the job they're doing.
Yeah. Manager is such a hard job to quantify. Yeah. I think that's what we're coming into after, you know, decades now of empirical baseball analysis, but bullpen management is something, it's the closest thing to play calling in other sports. It's like the only in-game, it's the biggest in-game impact that managers have, particularly now that, you know, you don't see as much bunting or hitting and running. Like, you don't see like the John McGraw type of stuff. Everybody's mostly swinging away in all situations. So it's how you manage your bullpen. And even then, it's not so much a matter of plugging in the right pegs in the right holes or the right situations. As much as it's that, it's about making the pegs want to go in those holes. And this is something, you know, Rob Thompson, the Phillies manager, I've been, you know, very, very complimentary of. I think he's a very good bullpen manager. It helps that he has a lot of good relief pitchers to use. But a part of that, and this is something that I've come out of with, you know, conversations with some of those pitchers, is that the team is very good at getting buy-in. Like knowing that, you know, this explaining that why the seventh inning when Judge and Soto are up is more important than the ninth inning with the bottom of the Yankees order up. And knowing that, for, you know, particularly you look at the way they've taken care of guys like Jose Alvarado and Matt Strom, giving them extensions. Like if we use you a lot, if you're going to throw 70 appearances and you're not getting saves, you're still going to get paid. It's, you know, stuff like that. And that's like an organizational top-down thing that I think teams are getting a lot better at. And also I think players are getting a lot smarter about, you know, you're getting guys who are a lot more, you know, this goes back to, I think the last time I was on, we talked about the pitchers I talked to at the draft combine. Players are much smarter than they were a decade ago. And they, you know, have a very good sense of where the pressure points are in games, and they know who's pitching those games. And so, you know, that's a different way to set up a bullpen hierarchy. But it's also a part of the manager's job to make everybody feel important so that you're getting the best out of them. And so that, you know, if a high leverage spot comes up in an unexpected place with an unexpected person on the mound, that pitcher has the confidence to go out and get those outs. So it's a huge complicated problem, but yeah. And that's sort of, you know, I was a little bit at a loss to draw an empirical conclusion in my story because there are so many moving parts to it.
Yeah. It's a great read though. And a great thought. Michael, we got to let you go. We're out of time here. Thanks so much, man.
All right. Thank you.
Michael Bauman of Fangraphs. Thank you to him for coming on. Thank you to Will Wagner of the Buffalo Bisons, the Doug Fox of Future Blue Jays newsletter, to Alan Doyle, one of my favorite musicians, and to Caitlin McGrath. You got Ennis and Barker 4-6 and postgame to help you out with the rest of it. 7:07 start tonight. We will talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.